This story is a work of fiction. Similarities between characters or events to persons living or dead in your world are purely coincidental. Only those who have agreed to the above have the privilege of partaking in this game.
Everyone, and welcome back to the Footy Dash podcast. I am here, as always, well, not always, with Lauren. Lauren, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. I got to do the whole, okay. Oshogatsu omedetou gozaimasu. Okay. Kotoshi mo yoroshiku onegai itashimasu. I'm not going to do any of that. Nobody cares about that. Anyway, yeah, so we're at a new year. We're beginning again. We're not starting over. We're just doing a new thing. I had an idea that I wanted to present to you because you're a smart person. You've had to think about games. You want to hear my idea?
Yes, I want to hear your cool idea.
Okay. So thesis, since we're academic types. JRPGs, so Japanese RPGs, don't exist.
Okay.
How do you feel about that? Mm-hmm.
You just killed a whole subgenre of the RPG on our entire listening community.
Yeah, just.
So, I also think my Twitter followers are going to be angry because I know a lot of them are adamantly in love with JRPGs.
So for every single person who has just logged off, I apologize. So yeah, actually, it's weird. I realize this is a strange argument, but I phrased the thesis in that way precisely because I want it to be provocative. I don't want to just shut people out. But I do have an argument to make. It's not just that doesn't exist. Bye, shortest episode ever. So, okay, it has to do with... Oh, okay, so let's begin with the beginning. So when people talk about JRPG, they don't just mean sort of an RPG, a role-playing game that was made in Japan. They mean a particular style of game. And in fact, I've actually seen people argue that there is such a thing as JRPGs not made by Japanese developers. So they're talking about a style in the same way that, unfortunately, people talk about manga style, which as a manga scholar, I would also like to say doesn't exist, but that's a different argument. Okay, so why doesn't that thing exist? So if you look at the sort of the two touchstone games for where this argument comes from, people almost always point to the original Dragon Quest and the original Final Fantasy, both originally console games. And so from these games, they then derive certain stylistic features that then become indicative of all JRPGs. Now, the reason why I would argue that the JRPG does not exist based on their own points of argument is that those games took their stylistic cues from the golden age of PC RPGs in the United States. And not
a
just
golden age is going to have a nice heavy scare quotes on it.
Yeah, just massive. It's referred to as the golden age of PC.
It is referred to as the golden age. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the term, we're not saying the golden age of RPGs was only in the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. And in many ways,
this is how the academia
a lot of these games
treats.
That I'm going to refer to are extremely dated. So this is not a judgment on the quality of them. It's more sort of a statement of, in other words, calling it the golden age is more like saying this is when PC RPGs came into their own rather than yes. saying this is the best of the best. Because like I said, a lot of these would not hold up to modern RPG games. So
exactly.
Let's see.
All right. Please continue.
I need some visual evidence for this. So I need to bring up my screen. Ah, many, many images. So I came upon this thesis. First want to give a shout out to the Internet Archive and their MS-DOS game software library, which is actually where I played a lot of these old games this past week. So I just wanted to give them a shout out. Okay, so the first thing that we need to talk about is this game, Portopia Renzoku Satsujin Jiken, or Portopia Serial Murder Cases, or Serial Murder Case. So this is a game made by a guy named Hori Yuri. I think that's his name. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm trying to remember this off the top of my head. And it's a visual novel, which is a classic type of Japanese video game. So if there is a kind of like distinctly Japanese genre, it is the visual novel. Although there are things that are sort of retroactively called that. But what's important about this game is that, so Hori was the lead designer on what would later be called Dragon Quest. So Toriyama Akira, the famous manga artist, did the character designs and sort of like the visual style of the game, but sort of in terms of the actual mechanics and the UI and all that stuff, that was Hori. So this was the first game that he ever worked on. And let's see if I can just bring up one of these screens for you guys. So you'll notice there, in terms of like the layout, Yuji. You'll notice that you have sort of like the bottom half of the screen is text, and then you have the sort of visual element on top. Let's see, I need to close that for a second. And then when you're playing the game, oftentimes you will have like, you know, character overlays, and then you have the dialogue, and then this is also where you generally enter your commands as well. It's all text-based. So this system for like dividing up the screen and thinking about sort of the user interface and how it's present and how information in the game is presented to you visually comes explicitly from this game, King's Quest I. Probably one of the most famous PC adventure games ever, designed by one of the most famous game designers of all time, Roberta Williams, like absolute like titan in the history of game design. And you'll notice it's a very similar kind of thing where you have, you know, the large visual element, you have, you know, the text entry interface down below. So Hori took that design of the game and put it right into Portopia. And why is Portopia important? Because Portopia, as a game that he worked on himself, provides the basis for what would later become the interface for Dragon Quest. So there is actually an explicit lineage. Like, and it's not just like, oh, well, there are interesting visual similarities. No, Hori himself admits to doing this. So that's element. So that's point number one. there are several points, but that's point number one. The other thing that I want you guys to think of is sort of like the classic style and design of, say, like the Final Fantasy games. And so for that, we're going to look at these tabs. So another really important PC RPG from the 80s is the Wizardry series. Really long running series. And I want you to take a look at this image right here. What does this remind you of? This is the exact same frame layout that is used in all of the early Final Fantasy games. And in fact, they even use the same font as the Wizardry series. So you have, again, another UI element that is explicitly taken from an American PC game. And then also, if you look at, say, the battle interface, that sort of the way in which, you know, you think of this sort of the tripartite structure of a classic Final Fantasy game where you have like a mob or a series of mobs here, you have your dudes here, and then you have a bunch of text stuff down here. Like, that framing is an adaptation of the battle interface from the early Wizardry games. It's taken explicitly from it. And the thing is, like, this is not just, again, not just a visual similarity. The designers admit to this. And the reason why is because even though nowadays we think of, in fact, I'm going to go back to Big Us. I'm going to go back to Big Us real quick. So the reason why I emphasize this is because even though nowadays we talk about Japanese RPG games as sort of like, I mean, they're a big part of the genre. And if, you know, a lot of people look to them. And in fact, in many ways, there was a time when so-called JRPGs or Japanese RPGs were actually more prominent than RPGs coming out of the Anglo-American and European markets. I mean, it's more balanced now than it used to be, but certainly like in the 90s, it was more heavily Japanese. But the thing is, prior to Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy, RPGs were actually considered to be a losing bet in the Japanese game industry. And in fact, the lead designer on the original Final Fantasy game when he pitched the idea for that game to his bosses at Square, so this is before it was Square Enix, they were like, nah, that's never going to work. That's a terrible idea. And it was only after Dragon Quest was successful that they actually greenlit the project. So the thing is, RPGs, PC RPGs were already a well-established, best-selling genre in the United States before Japanese companies even thought it was a good idea to try. So here's the thing. It's like, but then, as I said, sort of Japanese RPGs kind of became ascendant, more ascendant in the 90s, early 2000s. But the thing is, the reason why I'm trying to make this argument that there's no such thing as a Japanese RPG is not just because of that sort of early lineage. It's because there's this mutual interconnection between these developer markets that we consider to be distinct. They're constantly looking to each other. They're riffing off of each other. They're using each other's ideas. So this notion that somehow like the JRPG is this distinct, discrete category is absolutely ridiculous, precisely because of the historical lineage, the fact that they're constantly looking to each other, they're constantly adapting to what each other is doing. So you can only think of it as, you have to sort of like conceptually think of it as distinct, but when you look at, oh, sorry, sad Lauren with nothing left to drink. But when you actually look at what they were doing historically, you see there's this constant interplay. So the thing is, like, if you tried to define the JRPG, like, formally, you're always going to run into this basic historical problem of, like, all of those, like, formal elements that you'll point to, you can see something corresponding to them in the supposed other.
So I, for one, I will already go ahead and just admit here that I agree that JRPGs don't exist. My main opinion is that I don't like putting any sort of nationality or ethnicity to a moniker of a genre that has been as widespread and has been made by developers across the world. Exactly, and so a Japanese RPG, for me, that is like distinctly, say, would be Japanese, honestly, would be something like the visual novels coming out. And I know visual novel is not an RPG, for just to be clear, but would be something like Voltage, where there are office romances that you play on your phone that are very distinctly Japanese, even translated into English, with the types of feelings that the player character is feeling, the types of relationships that are like kind of troped in like office romances. And even if it's like the Chinese god comes to Japan and you have to choose between seven of them, like it still is very authentically Japanese, right? And I don't think that Voltage-like games would come out of America because our culture, right, is very different. Yeah. And you'll actually see this in Voltage's own marketing, where they even have changed the art style of their games for games that have writers in Europe or writers in America.
Yeah.
And then because of all of that, Voltage also has had a terrible, I think, 2020 explosion as well for not paying their writers. So this is not to say, please go and download all of Voltage's products. It's to say, go find the writers, support them. And then figure that out. And I wanted to make two very distinct arguments, however, not so much maybe to counter Nicholas's point here for that JRPGs don't exist, but I want our listeners to understand why I believe, from a storytelling and design perspective, that JRPG as a genre has gotten such attention. And it doesn't come down to, say, the aesthetics or the historical accuracy or like the lineage of these games, because that is undeniable from those creators themselves, right? But my two points are going to be, one, basically in that player choice and character. And the second argument is going to be about the visual novel as something that Nicholas had brought up as distinctly Japanese. And we'll go into that kind of to modernize this as well. So we're not just talking about wizardry the whole time. If you look, right, so if we go all the way back, pre-wizardry, pre-video games, to still video games, because it used a computer interface, we'd look at the technological limitations of being able to, what we call is role play.
Yeah.
And role play as a game or as a, honestly, just as a chat service, you're on AOL, you're that kid, you're 10 years old pretending that you're 16, and you are pretending to be, Inuyasha or something, right? In your like IRC chat. And you were just talking to everybody, but you're as a different character. I mean, you did the sprite as a kid when you played Home or you played Barbies. Those are two very obviously like girly examples because I got raised as a girl. So I played
House when I was a kid. I
also played, I played Sailor Moon actually as a kid. So I wanted to be Sailor Mars, but my hair, okay, was like blonde. And so I had to be Sailor Venus, who was very not me. I'm actually more Sailor Mercury. But then I didn't have short hair. So the short haired friend had to be Sailor Mercury. Like, you see what I'm getting at now? You have these characters, right? You're supposed to fit into that role. And now you're as children, you're like, oh, you don't look like that. So you can't be that.
Yeah,
that is the definitional argument when we look at a JRPG, because the biggest distinction between American games that were coming out in the 80s and also Dungeons and Dragons as a genre, like just as the case, I don't want to say the precursor to all of this, but is obviously a very strong foundation to RPGs in general, right? Is modernizing and systemizing, right? Role-playing game mechanics, not just in terms of statistics or systems, but in terms of self-insertion, you become a character, right? And also, right, in terms of once you have that character, that progression that takes them from, right, level one adventurer, like gets killed by a rat, to level 20 adventurer kills a Trarrasque, which is basically a giant dinosaur. And in JRPGs, what we notice with the two titles you brought up, loosely, right, with Dragon Quest and with Final Fantasy, versus when you look at Wizardry or you look at, say, even Neverwinter Nights, right? That's that's an example. It's from the 90s, not the 80s, but
So for those of you who don't know, the original Neverwinter Nights was from 91, and it was what was, it was made by a company called SSI, and it was what was in the gold, so-called gold box series of RPGs. Sorry, go ahead, Lauren.
No, I'm really glad you brought that data. When we look at, and I'm also actually going to talk about Legend of Zelda as well, because it is very distinct from the Final Fantasy and from Dragon Quest. And here's why, I will get to it. Japanese role-playing games, and this isn't distinct to Japan and it isn't distinct to either's, but I think the reason why so many of you are listening right now and being so upset that JRPG doesn't exist, I can feel you. You are with rage, but you're still listening. So thank you for listening. Is that for you, you really got invested in the character arc of the person the Japanese role-playing game told you you could be.
Yes.
You are viscerally upset at that. You don't remember Wizardry. Maybe you've never played Neverwinter Nights. You've never created a hero. But when you are presented with Link and someone's saying that is not a Japanese RPG, you are like, no, Link is the hero. I am like, Link has that character arc, right? I'm going to bring up Final Fantasy VII as a huge indicator for my life because it was one of the first games that didn't look at player choice, right? Or maybe consequences or the choose your own adventure part of a role-playing game as an RPG. Final Fantasy VII pushed the characters of an RPG. It pushed the story. Yes. It pushed the relationships between people. And I think that that right there is what really defines the JRPG in the consumer's mindsets. They'll never say it. They'll say it's the anime style. They'll say it's, oh, well, it has Japanese like words like mana, which is not a Japanese word, by the way.
Yeah, it's a Hebrew word.
It's a Hebrew word. It's like bread coming from the sky, whatever.
Exactly. Magic bread.
It's magic bread. but all of these things is that people are, you know, they'll say about the style, they'll say it's the visual novel, they'll look at the aesthetics. But when you really, really break it down to, I think, the emotional heart, right? The thing that really gets you invested in that experience is that when you look at something like a Dragon Age game, and then we're putting Mass Effect aside, right? When you look at a Dragon Age like experience, you're really creating a self-insertion of your character. Skyrim is the best example of this because it is something where you are truly playing Wizardry when you are playing Skyrim. You are playing a completely blank slate hero that has nothing to do with your character. It has doesn't matter who you are. You're going to get the same story. You're going to get the same interactions and you're going to get the same level of experience, whether or not you beat the game or you decide to engage with the story. Compare that to Final Fantasy VII, where that game is completely about, right, all of the characters. And it's completely about the relationships. And yes, maybe you are going to get the same experience narratively, but you as a player are bringing your own emotional experience, your own emotional quality or awareness of what you have to that game genre.
Yeah.
And so for me, the reason why the JRP, I would say, trope or genre has existed for so long is that to imagine a Japanese role-playing game without characters that you can identify with, I think does not exist.
See, here's the thing, though. That is something that those games developed into. So to use the specific example of Final Fantasy, the original Final Fantasy game, like you picked particular classes of characters that you wanted to use, but they had no identity, really. They were just fighter. They were just black belt. They were just black mage. They were just white mage. That's it. Like you pick types. You didn't pick like specific characters. But over time, you were right, Lauren, that one of the things that, again, using the example specifically of Final Fantasy, but you can also see this in other like later games, like, you know, the Grandia series. It's in all of them. They developed specific characters who represented those roles. So for example, like if you're thinking about like, say, Final Fantasy X, you don't have a white mage, you have Yuna as a white mage. In other words, you have a specific person who represents that type, and your investment in your relationship as a player with that person's story, you're right, is very different. And the thing that you pointed out about sort of like the kind of the blank slate, you know, the sort of the character creation system that we're kind of all used to now in so many different games, seen most recently and probably most extensively in Baldur's Gate 3, where there's just so many sliders. And in fact, even when I was playing Inquisition recently, there's so many things that you can change. That is not necessarily distinctly Western things. So I wanna bring back up my screen share real quick to show you guys an old game. So this is another one of those gold box sort of D&D derivative games. It's called Gateway to the Savage Frontier. This is actually the same year, you'll notice, as Neverwinter Nights. And if you go to the, let me maximize this, you go to the character creation. I don't know, what do you want to create, Lauren? Want to create a
let's create a half-elf.
Half-elf, let's go for it. Let's go with female for reasons. What class do you, so by the way, this is second edition rules, so this is advanced Dungeons and Dragons. That's why you have all these complex
can we be a fighter magic user thief?
All right, fighter magic user thief, there we go. what align, so you guys see what we're doing here? Like we're literally going, like this is the origin of that sort of character creation system. In fact, it's not even the origin. The origin is actually the pen and paper D&D game, where that's one of the very first things that you do. You're just doing this with like, you know, your paper doll and your stat sheet. Whereas here it's been, I'm going to make them chaotic evil, by the way. And you know, and then you can reroll stats. You can do all that stuff. Let's just pick these stats. I don't care. So we're going to call them Feldra for some reason, because that's the first name that I can't. So here, interestingly enough, we get at least the video game origin of all those sliders, where like literally you can pick particular parts and then you can like cycle through different heads. Let's just keep that one for now. You can cycle through different appearances for weapons. Let's go with that one. And then you can screw with the colors on the body. You can change the size. You can make them small or large. You don't get a whole lot of options, but this is where that system comes from. It comes from these gold box games. And so it's interesting because this is something that sort of the so-called Western. So this is something that the Western games kept, but actually the Japanese games discarded. And the reason why I point this out is because you see something like it in that original Final Fantasy game, but they evolved away from it. And it's analogous to something that we talked about in our previous episode, where like Japanese cyberpunk and Anglo-American cyberpunk are reacting to the same moment in like science fiction, but they have different reactions and they have divergent reactions. And then they come back together and they diverge and they come back together and they diverge. And so what you're talking about is one of those points of divergence.
I think that everything that we're talking about when people are trying to go back, and if you go to the original Final Fantasies and the historical lineage of it, where the RPG in every country, right, is say similar. I think that point of divergence is really, really key, because that's really when the players of my generation, right, in the 90s, and like my generation being millennials, which is really, really wide as a birthday year, is really when these games were finally being imported, say for real, into America. And like these players were able to react, and we had this very big distinction, because I don't think JRPG really existed in the 90s in terms of people were like talking about it. Yeah. Like at least at my, and especially at my age, we'd be like, what is J? What does RPG mean? Like, this is a video game I play. I have an adventure.
Yeah.
And I think that that point of divergence was so clear in our minds, because we had players that maybe were older us, players that were playing PC versus playing console, were playing things like Elder Scrolls or like Neverwinter Nights. And they're like, no, you create your own character and this is you, which in some could argue is a more personal experience. I don't really agree with that. And then the J, right? The RPGs that were coming out of Japan were much more, here is your typical character class, and this is how this person would act. And I want to really own up to that as well, because there's a very popular game that no one would consider as an RPG, but uses this method of, and then please forgive me for saying this, Japanese storytelling. As you are the white mage, you are Yuna, because a white mage would obviously be really helpful, be really demure, right? Would be really pure, would obviously be the woman, right? Like a white mage was never a male, right? Necessarily.
It is,
and
a
that's not necessarily.
It's a recognizable form of Japanese misogyny.
It is a recognizable form.
Not
to discount American misogyny. However, I also want to discount this though, or not discount. I also want to parallel this to a very popular title that actually uses this very well to its advantage for its character tropes, for its characters. And that's Overwatch. Their main support class that everyone plays, that is the white mage, is Mercy.
Right.
And that is a very American game. And so what I want to say is that like this type of storytelling isn't something that's very unique to the Japanese RPG style, but that even within our culture, say globally, universally, we see someone as who only wants to support, who only wants to do healing. I mean, obviously they're a good person. They're merciful. Right. And so we use those universally, especially with our characters and in storytelling, just in general, even in like even in books, right? Or in movies where someone goes, they're a good person. Their name is Mercy. Right. And I think that's really, really crucial. The second aspect of this character, the characterization of classes, right, in Japanese role playing, the Japanese role playing game genre, is something you brought up earlier that I really want to talk about, which is the visual novel. And I think that the UI or the user interface, right, of talking to people and figuring out their lives, and either there are consequences or there are no consequences, but interplaying with that relationship is something that I don't want to say directly stemmed from Japanese games in the way of the visual novel, but I almost kind of want to make that argument, because even though this was seen in things like Knights of the Old Republic, Neverwinter Nights, like talking and choice and dialogue was all there. When you really got to the level of fidelity of a full-on cutscene with choices or a full-on visual novel experience, the visual novel is a genre where I think that will break down. Is it or is it not Japanese? Because the visual novel is not a Japanese genre. Not exclusively, and most notably seen with one of my favorite games, or actually two of my favorite games, one of them being, I think, American and one of them being Australian, is Necro Barista and Coffee Talk. Yes, they are both games about coffee. Necro Barista is a huge visual novel, and it is absolutely fantastic and has really cool game mechanic systems. And then, right, Coffee Talk is completely a visual novel with just kind of almost matching to make sure you find like the perfect drink for someone.
Yeah.
And so I think that those two aspects of the visual novel really did stem from these games that happened to come out of Japan that utilized, right, the class system, like a white mage or a dark mage, and then turned them into characters. But then also in that had that very traditional, what we would call Japanese in scare quotes style of a character portrait and that UI text block. Right. And then a visual novel being exclusively just that. And now visual novels may or may not have additional mechanics.
And, but that's the thing is that, so the reason why I try to make, I mean, sort of the fairer argument would be to say that like JRPG is not a discrete category. Like if I were if I were to write a research paper, like I would say, like, this is not useful as a distinct category. I mean, I was more provocative about it, but I think that's really the point, because what you're pointing to and what I'm pointing to and how this, all this comes together is that the thing is, like, so if a Japanese company comes out with a game and they do something really interesting and really novel, guess what? People all over the world can play it. They can see it for themselves and say, hey, that is a really cool mechanic, or that's a really interesting visual style. And if they're a designer, they can say, I'm going to work that into my game. And so that's what the point that I was trying to make, is that the Japanese designers were doing that with American games. And then now you have, you know, Euro-American designers doing this with, like, doing the same. Because think about, say, like, you know, Baldur's Gate 3 or like Dragon Age Inquisition, like those have really complex, like, flirting and romantic systems built into them that I, if I had to guess, is probably taken explicitly from Japanese games. Because and that's what I mean by it's not actually helpful to think about this like discrete JRPG category. What you actually want to look at to are these points of divergence, reconvergence, you know, mutual influence, like, you know, Japanese people can play American video games and Americans can play Japanese video games. And being humans and being creative, like, we can take different things from them depending upon our personal experience, our cultural backgrounds, like all of these other things that filter in. And so, Lauren, you're right to point to sort of like the cultural element being more important than the formal element, precisely because, you know, you have a culture of a games industry in Japan, you have a culture of a games industry in the US, you have cultures of games industries in, you know, European countries, you have a culture of the games industry in China, which is also very different. Like, they're all going to see this, the same thing, but then do different things with it.
Yep. And I think that we should still not get away from the provocative argument of JRP games do not exist,
yeah.
Despite you having talked to a more fairer academic approach, is because we in America need to stop looking at a game that comes out of China and calling it a Chinese RPG, or looking at a game like Black Desert Online and being like, that is a, I don't know if that's, that, maybe that is still Chinese. Or like looking at a game that's like, this is a Korean RPG. This is a Japanese RPG. We have to stop doing that. And precisely because these games like Black Desert Online is amazing in a lot of different ways. And if we keep referencing it to the culture of the nation that it comes from, we are limiting ourselves as developers in America or in Europe or in Australia or wherever you are from doing amazing work. Because if the developers of Necrobarista were like, we're making a Japanese visual novel, I really feel like they exploded that and made a really distinctly Australian piece. Like, there are just the way they talk, the cultural aspects of it. I really felt like I was a barista specifically in Australia, despite it not even really, it takes kind of place in Australia, but it's not really about Australia. But like, the culture is infused with that. And that's amazing, right? And it's because they made an Australian visual novel, right? Like, they made a visual novel, full stop. Maybe it had influences from Japan. I mean, it probably did, but it also had influences from Canada, had influences from Vancouver's barista scene, probably had influences from San Francisco, right? That's super big in coffee. Yeah. Probably had influences from the Japanese coffee scene, right? Yeah. And so when we look at this cultural aspect of this genre, we cannot put this RPG as a JRPG, because now you're limiting whatever you want to design as a game developer in your own work. And that's just like, absolutely ridiculous. Don't do that. We can't limit ourselves anymore. So no K, no J, no C. And then it's a problem with Pan Asia specifically. And we're not going to get into that right now. No French RPGs. Okay.
FRPGs.
You can have an RPG specific, no FRPGs. Okay. No UK RPGs. And you can create that for yourself if you want to make a game that is an RPG that's, say, distinctly Gaelic, right? Or like Scottish Gaelic. Cool. See, make a distinctly Scots RPG.
I really appreciate, as a half Scot, I really appreciate. Lauren also speaks a little bit of the Gaelic, as they say, because that's how it's pronounced. Because if you're from Scotland, it's Gaelic. Only Irish people say Gaelic.
That's very, very true.
Gallagher.
Exactly. So if you want to do that, that's amazing. And then, you know, emphasize, right, the Scotsness of your RPG, but don't limit yourself because you're like, oh, our art style is too Japanese. Like, no, that's bullshit, and get rid of it. I actually don't remember if we're supposed to curse or not on this, but.
That's okay. We can get an occasional one. That is fantastic. I'm glad you brought that home, Lauren. That's where we're going to take a break. And, you know, you guys will be hearing the next part probably in a week or so, but we are probably going to be doing it in a couple of minutes or so. But thank you all for listening. It's been a pleasure. I hope you're infuriated. I hope you want to go make the game that proves us wrong, because that will probably be an amazing game and we would love to play it.